Diversity.
Here you have caused confusion.
I'll crash its board.
Well, hello, everyone. Today, I want to read a section of a book by my favorite rogue Marxist historian and writer, James Hartfield, Britain's Empires. And I specifically want to read a section towards the end that he calls Woke Imperialism. I thought this would be of interest to people. And I'm going to try to read uninterrupted because there's quite a bit to get through. But I will pause for comment as and when necessary. All right, so let us make a start. Humanitarian intervention. The 1990 to 91 Gulf War and the war in Bosnia after it had a dramatic impact on how international relations were organized. Lessons that were laid down in the Gulf War with the military action that could be taken when it was in the name of the international community. The rationale for military action beyond the rights of self-defense that were deemed acceptable and proper were those undertaken for humanitarian reasons, in particular to stop genocide, aggression, and to prevent harm. The working out of the new ethos of humanitarian intervention took place in the nexus of debate between ministers and civil servants, the military, with a big contribution by aid and human rights organizations. Their role was considered so novel that they were gathered under the category of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, though skeptics pointed out that they were often largely government-funded bodies. The debate over the new humanitarianism reached a curious intensity, with international trouble spots dominating the news agenda throughout the 1990s and 2000s. Arguments were overwrought with moral intensity, as it seemed that not to act would be complicit in atrocities or genocide. It was a debate that broke down the usual demarcation lines of left and right too. Many people on the left were ardently committed to military intervention, whereas many on the right were skeptical about the extension of British power beyond her national interests. It would be wrong to say that this was a debate that engaged the general public. Rather, it was carried on among the liberal intelligentsia and the somewhat less liberal military and civil service. The new humanitarian foreign policy was so different that it led to a big shift in international relations theory. Where it had been assumed that the essential building block out of which all international relations were made was the sovereign state, a new liberal internationalist theory downgraded the nation as actor, elevating, in theory at least, the non-governmental actor, the international community and international organizations. The United Charter of 1945, Article 2.7, reads, "Nothing contained in the present charter shall authorize the United Nations to intervene in matters which are essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state." That clause defended the ideal of national sovereignty. In the new liberal internationalism, the national sovereignty clause seemed to be out of date and a barrier to humanitarian action. States could resist intervention on the grounds that the international community had no business interfering with their domestic jurisdiction. Jeffrey Robertson, QC, served as a judge in the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal in Sierra Leone. His book, Crimes Against Humanity, makes the case against sovereignty. The great play of sovereignty, with all its pomp and panoply, can now be seen for what it hides, a posturing troupe of human actors who, when off stage, are sometimes prone to rape the chorus. Similarly, Kenneth Roth, executive director of the organization Human Rights Watch, argued, Sovereignty cannot be used as an excuse to avoid human rights commitments. Columbia University professor Samuel Moyne, in a careful history of the emergence of human rights as a focus for international law, explains that it was the decline of radical alternatives to the status quo, in particular the anti-colonial movements, that left human rights as the main area of ameliorative action. The argument over humanitarian intervention was not academic. All of the post-Cold War military interventions that Britain was involved in were undertaken in the name of humanitarianism, and self-interested motivation was denied. These were the majority military engagements British forces fought. There was the Gulf War from 1990 to 91, the Bosnian War from 92 to 95, Operation Desert Fox against Iraq in 1998, the Kosovo War in 1999, Sierra Leone Civil War between 2000 and 2002, the war in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2014, the Iraq War from 2003 to 2009, the Libyan Civil War in 2011, Operation Shader in Iraq and Syria between 2014 and the present, and the Persian Gulf crisis. I would argue that we could also add Ukraine to that list. I'm not entirely sure when this book was published, but I don't see Ukraine mentioned, but surely he would add it now. In every case, apart from the Sierra Leone incursion, British forces were part of a coalition with the United States or part of a United Nations or NATO force. Humanitarian intervention was by no means military intervention alone. United Nations missions did much more than use military force. Missions undertook conflict resolution, capacity building with new regimes, trained police forces, and undertook extensive educational and welfare roles. Most strikingly, the United Nations created ad hoc investigations into war crimes. The most important of these were the United Nations criminal tribunals that investigated and tried leaders in the conflict in the former Yugoslavia in 1993, Rwanda in 1994, and Cambodia in 2003. Britain's 1997 regime change. Tony Blair's Labour Party won a handsome victory in the general election on the 2nd of May 1997 and again in 2001 and in 2005. The Conservative Party was exhausted morally and programmatically after four terms of office. Blair very successfully cleansed the party's brand of its old associations with top-down state socialism and the trade union leadership, campaigning against both conservatism and Labour's own traditional working class base. Blair positioned it as quote-unquote New Labour, a post-ideological party that would rule technocratically, committed to free markets and detraditionalizing society. He was very successful at showing what was wrong with the old ways, but less so at setting out what was new. Though the party won the popular vote, it failed to build a strongly committed following, and its critics complained, suffered from an ideological and moral vacuum at its centre. Tony Blair advanced a political appeal that he called the Third Way, that was neither socialist nor conservative, for markets and the state. The post-ideological approach appealed to people who could see that the older solutions were not working, and chime with a generation of world leaders from Lionel Jospin in France to Bill Clinton in America. It was less successful in presenting a positive appeal in its own right, and its reforms were piecemeal and uninspiring. Many, like the Antisocial Behaviour Order, aka ASBO, and the Private Finance Initiative, created more problems than they solved. Throughout his term of office, Tony Blair was a militant supporter of humanitarian intervention, where the domestic political agenda often seemed like a quagmire. Dramatic action overseas was especially appealing to a leader with a keen sense of his place in history. Through the course of the Bosnia conflict, the Conservative government was put on the back foot over its cautious approach. That was a novelty in British politics in the 1980s, especially over the Falklands conflict. It was the left that was cast as cowardly and attacked for not backing, quote unquote, our boys. Labour's policy of unilateral nuclear disarmament was scoffed at from the Tory benches. With the Bosnia conflict, the cliche of right-wing belligerents versus left-wing milquetoasts was disrupted. The Bosnia war did not influence the outcome of the 1997 election. Popular support for the war in 1993 had in fact waned by 1995. The importance of the new thinking on overseas policy was not in the polling booths, but in the confidence of the Labour Party leadership and activists. They were in the right on this issue, as on many others. Having cringed at the prospect of arguing Labour's non-nuclear alternative defence strategy on the doorsteps in the 1980s, the party was feeling ebullient. Radical intellectuals after the Cold War were more excited by the possibilities of military intervention overseas. Labour's policymakers were of a similar frame of mind. A youthful and energetic Labour Party won in May 1997. The liberal internationalism of the foreign policy debate shaped Labour's thinking. Foreign Secretary Robin Cook set out the approach. This is Robin Cook. The Labour government does not accept that political values can be left behind when we check in our passports to travel on diplomatic business. Our foreign policy must have an ethical dimension and must support the demands of other peoples for democratic rights on which we insist for ourselves. The Labour government will put human rights at the heart of foreign policy. Ugh. Ugh. Anyway, that is what Robin Cook said. The recasting of Britain's foreign policy in 1997 marked the change in administration from Conservative John Major to Tony Blair, and it had wider implications, most pointedly in the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. The Blair government also shifted Britain's policy on Europe. The previous Conservative administrations of Margaret Thatcher and John Major had been sceptical members of the European Economic Community. Tony Blair, by contrast, was an enthusiastic supporter of the European Union, as it had become under the Maastricht Treaty of 1993. In the first instance, Blair's pro-Europeanism was a challenge to the domestic audience, a way of painting both the Labour left wing and the Conservatives as backward-looking little Englanders. For Blair, Britain's history of grudging engagement with the continent was a tragedy of missed opportunities. Blair did not see participation in the Union as the loss of British power. He told Labour's conference in 2002 that it was our destiny to lead in Europe. Britain's pro-European turn in 1997 coincided with greater prospects for the Union's Commonwealth foreign policy. Cambridge University's Christopher Bickerton explains that in the Cold War era, European foreign policy cooperation was stymied by the way those global tensions aggravated differences among European nations. The post-Cold War era, it seemed, held out new prospects for European cooperation. Though, as Tony Blair highlighted, the Union was a superstate, not a superpower, something that he hoped he could fix. More cooperation at the European level suited his ambitions for a liberal internationalism and for international cooperation in policing the world. Practically, though, Britain under Blair adopted international alliances in an ad hoc way. The European Union was a useful platform from which Britain attempted to isolate Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe, and it shouldered some of the burden of overseeing the administration of Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Union proved to be an unwieldy vehicle for international cooperation on the whole. However, because of its incoherent policy-making process, which would become clear when it was confronted with an issue, which would become clear when it was confronted with a crisis in the Ukraine. So maybe, I don't know if he's talking about the crisis in Ukraine in 2014, or this was actually written after the conflict with Putin started, but anyway. All right, so the next few sections go over some history where we look at Kosovo in 1999, Afghanistan in 2001, Iraq in 2003. Now, we don't need to go over all that history, but he's highlighting Blair's role and Labour, New Labour's role in the kind of mission statements and war of humanitarian values that were involved in each of those military interventions. So I will skip that bit. Let's get to the humanitarian intervention after Iraq. It says, before and after the 9/11 attack on America, international relations were turned upside down and then upside down again. George Bush's and Condoleezza Rice's threatened withdrawal from the international community was halted and reversed. Under George W. Bush, America was once again fiercely engaged in the world. Britain, as Tony Blair foresaw, would make a role for itself as the bridge across the Atlantic, making the case for America in Europe and for Europe in America, so enhancing its own authority. As a champion of international cooperation, albeit of a yet more militantly forward kind, Britain would secure its own status in the world. That vision was developed by Tony Blair's growing club of admirers. In 2006, John Bew and Gabriel Glickman wrote a manifesto called The British Moment for their think tank, the Henry Jackson Society, named for an Atlanticist American senator. They then tried to distill the lessons of the preceding decade. And this is the Henry Jackson Society. From the British perspective, those who would support the principles of humanitarian intervention or the spread of liberal democracy converge on the ground that we would call a progressive foreign policy. In the same collection, James Rogers and Matthew Jameson set out a 6-point plan to realise what they called the British moment. And these are the bullet points. Commitment to Britain's economic dynamism, maintenance of a strong military, standing against mass murder in greater Europe and beyond, support the spread of democracy, commitment to universal human rights, and commitment to the European Union and enhancing relations with America. Around the same time, a similar group were meeting in Houston, where they set out another manifesto called the Houston Manifesto. It was similar to the British Moment statement, though more argumentative, making the case against anti-Americanism for quote-unquote historical truth, and with a more explicit commitment to fighting racism and for women's rights. The founders of the group were Alan Johnson, Eve Garrard, Nick Cohen, Shalom Lapin, and Norman Grass. What both groups had in common was a belief that British overseas intervention was a likely vehicle to achieve these goals. That way, they were both defenders of Blair's government's commitment to humanitarian intervention. The difficulty for the proponents of humanitarian intervention was that the actual interventions were looking more and more inhumane, with the death toll in the coalition wars ratcheting up from hundreds to thousands to hundreds of thousands. The claim that Britain was a force for good was looking more threadbare. In the 1990s, the wars against Adid in Somalia, Milosevic in Bosnia and Kosovo, and against Saddam in Iraq were not met with mass opposition. The Iraq War of 2003 set a completely different precedent. Millions of protesters opposed the 2003 Iraq War, marching in Washington, London, Paris, Berlin, Madrid, and Athens, and millions more across the Middle East. The champions of intervention had enjoyed the moral high ground in the 90s, but from 2003 they were cast as defenders of a brutal and barbaric policy. The rationale for the Iraq War, the alleged presence of weapons of mass destruction, failed to materialize, as also the alleged link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda was never demonstrated. The moral high ground was turning into a bog. Steadfast champions of humanitarian intervention in the 1990s became opponents of war, like the campaigning journalists Ed Vuliamy and Martin Bell, do you remember, in the white suit, while Robin Cook, the original champion of an ethical foreign policy, opposed war in Parliament. In the 1990s, the anti-war left, Tony Blair, Jeremy Corbyn, and Diane Abbott was isolated and mocked for being old-fashioned, while these same figures found themselves addressing crowds of hundreds of thousands of people in 2003. In America, too, George W. Bush's very successful and popular war was slowly turned into a sour anti-insurgency that cost American lives and drained American self-confidence. In 2008, Bush was defeated by a remarkable young senator from Illinois, Barack Obama, who rode into the White House on a wave of youth rebellion, whipped up by a promise to get out of Iraq. Obama's political orientation was very close to Tony Blair's, and his election was, in no sense, a repudiation of the broader project of humanitarian intervention. But his popular support was premised on a desire to end the Iraq war, among other issues that were pressing at the time, notably the financial crash of 2008. After 2005, the case for humanitarian intervention would never again be popular with the public, though it was still fundamental to many politicians' ideas about Britain's place in the world. In 2007, Tony Blair succumbed to a sustained campaign by his second-in-command, Gordon Brown, to vacate 10 Downing Street. At the end of his premiership, Timothy Garton Ash asked Tony Blair what the essence of Blairism was. "It is liberal interventionism," Blair answered. "I am a proud interventionist." The meaning of humanitarian intervention. For the proponents of, and hopefully people can see why I'm sharing this, because it's very prescient for the current moment, the thinking of the current government, and indeed the Conservatives over the past 14 years or so, and Britain's foreign policy at the current moment. Apart from the Israeli piece of the jigsaw, which doesn't quite fit into all of this, the belligerence on Ukraine, anti-Putinism and so on, I think is wrapped up with this whole way of thinking about quote-unquote liberal interventionism. Anyway, for proponents of the humanitarian intervention, the reasons for action were easily understood. The compelling motive was the threat to human security and rights from dictatorial regimes and ethno-nationalist movements. Humanitarian intervention was an internationalist response to the problem of human security. The conceptual meaning was that the old system of sovereign nation states was solipsistic and a warrant for dictatorship and oppression. Military action in pursuit of mere national interest, or worse, predatory and oppressive motive, were to be abjured. The responsibility to act was an idealistic expression of human community that transcended national boundaries. The agents of intervention were armies and governments, but their selfish motives were tempered by action in concert through international cooperation and institutions like the United Nations, the Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and so on. Those traditional actors were added to by a new set of agents, the non-governmental organizations, the NGOs, aid organizations, human rights advocates, environmental pressure groups, and so on. These added up, it was claimed, to an international, quote-unquote, civil society that would make up the legitimacy that the imperfect national policies no longer provided. The growing ranks of the critics of humanitarian intervention saw things differently. They simply did not believe the claims to disinterested motivations on the part of the proponents of humanitarian intervention. These ideals were, in the eyes of the critics, just a mask for venal and vested interests. In this way, champions and critics alike tended to see themselves as representatives of idealism, with the critics casting the champions as hypocrites. On their marches, the anti-war protesters excoriated the Prime Minister as Tony B. Liar. It was, they said, a war for oil, not a war for democracy. Unmasking the pecuniary interests behind the high ideals was the argument they felt most comfortable making. Both champions and critics of humanitarian intervention contrasted their chosen course with the old politics of empire. The champions had claimed that their interventions were a break with the old policies of empire because they were not selfish or predatory. The critics struck a harsh blow when they replied that the interventions in Iraq, Yugoslavia, and Somalia were examples of humanitarian imperialism, since the ideals claimed were just a disguise for selfish interests, then it stood to reason that the new liberal internationalism was in truth just the old imperialism dressed up in fancy new clothes. After the Iraq debacle, it was harder to argue that the instigation of war crimes by international tribunals was disinterested idealism. Rather, it seemed that the selection of which belligerents might be investigated was governed by brute reality. The evidence that the US service personnel had tortured and killed innocent Iraqis and ridden roughshod over their human rights was not going to be investigated at The Hague. The United States resolutely opposed submitting its nationals to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The ad hoc justice of the international war crime tribunals punished those who were outside of Western favor while protecting those who were favored allies. Friend-enemy distinction. The Serb leaders, Mladic, Karadzic, and Milosevic, were persecuted. The last died of a heart attack while conducting his own defense. But the authoritarian leaders of Croatia and Bosnia, Franjo Tudjman and Alija Izetbegović, were never called to account for the actions of their armed forces that their armed forces took against civilians. Even the terms of the Rwandan tribunal excluded atrocities that the forces of the Rwandan Patriotic Front undertook before 1992 and against refugees after 1994. That fell outside of its remit. Later on, Western diplomats began to suspect that their champion of human rights in Rwanda, President Paul Kagame, you know, Paul Kagame, the same one that they tried to make the Rwanda deal with, the Tories did, that is, was sanctioning the assassination of dissidents overseas. Not just the war crimes tribunals were tarnished by the selective justice of humanitarian intervention. And today, of course, we would easily add Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu to this double standard that the regime has on this front. I will mention that I'll pause at this point to say I like the way that Hartfield deftly shows that the opponents of the liberal imperialists basically use the same moral frame. So Corbyn and Diane Abbas and all of these clowns, they use the same moral frame as the regime to criticize the regime. Now, you could say that's good Saul Alinsky tactics, rules for radicals, but it does lead to a kind of trap in a way, because essentially you're not escaping the truth regime of, the liberal imperialists. Anyway, not just the war crimes tribunals were tarnished by selective justice of humanitarian intervention. Media outlets like CNN and the New York Times, and in Britain, the Times and the Guardian, were seen to have carried fake stories about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. The one-sided accounts of the just allies and the evil Iraqi regime were hard to square with the dawning realization that the coalition forces were deeply unpopular and casually oppressive. Many journalists who had uncritically repeated British government war propaganda were invited to eat their hats when those stories turned out to be less than the unvarnished truth. Press coverage of conflicts overseas were viewed with greater skepticism after Iraq. Connor Foley, who had worked for Liberty, Amnesty International, and the UNHCR as a defender of humanitarian intervention, Foley worried about the way the Iraq War of 2003 had undermined the argument for intervention, trying to imagine how things looked to those people on the other side of the argument. For anti-imperialists, the invasion was the culmination of a period of misguided Western intervention that has seen the weakening of both national sovereignty and international law. Foley went on, in the voice of the anti-imperialists he had argued with, Iraq exposed the folly of the belief that human rights and democracy can ever be imposed on other countries by force of arms. And further, such rhetoric, they argue, makes a more traditional concern with securing Western strategic, economic, and political interests. The doctrine of humanitarian intervention, they maintain, is just a new name for old-fashioned imperialism. The people that Foley was talking about were the anti-war left and other critics of humanitarian imperialism. They included writers like the late Peter Gowan and Tariq Ali at the New Left Review. the veteran anti-war scholar and activist Noam Chomsky, and his collaborator Ed Herman, the scholar David Waring, and the Stop the War activist Lindsay German. They echoed the point of view of the activists writing articles and books about the war for oil, and they were called the Humanitarian Imperialism, the title of a 2006 book by Jean Bickermont. Though occasionally the anti-imperialist left would use the term New Imperialism, the title of a 2005 book for the Oxford University Press by David Harvey, their main rhetorical strategy was to emphasize the continuity between the new humanitarian imperialism of the 1990s and the old school imperialism of the 1890s. The human rights claims were just a facade, they said, for all the old school imperialists were missionaries who talked about anti-slavery before clapping you and I ends too. Oil interests were the real motives for war and the quest for new bases overseas to intimidate the natives. The anti-imperialist critique of humanitarian imperialism had a point, but it also had a weakness. The emphasis on continuity between the past imperialism and the modern humanitarian intervention risked losing sight of what was new. The liberal interventionist claims that international relations are about more than self-interested states had a point. What they were describing was a new factor in foreign policy that did not follow the self-limiting rules of sovereignty, as argued by Douglas Hurd and the students of the Realist School of International Relations. The argument that it was the West's demand for oil that was driving the humanitarian interventions was hard to stand up. After all, it would have been a lot cheaper to buy the oil from Saddam than to spend what was estimated to be more than $1 trillion to fight the war. If the goal was only to make money, the Iraq war was already a disastrous failure. The majority of Iraq's 200-odd state-owned factories are white elephants full of outdated equipment, reported the Kansas City Star. Now, I don't want to get bogged down in the details of Iraq and so on here, but you can see that the argument he's making, that the anti-imperial left basically are missing something when they claim that all they're after is money or profit is the main motive, and this is just old-fashioned imperialism. Hartfield is making a deeper point that this is a new thing that we're seeing. And this is what I wanted to go on to, the point of this video, which is what I'm calling, or what he calls in this book, woke imperialism. He says the anti-war protesters were right in one sense about the Iraqi war. It did echo many aspects of the old imperialism. At its heart, it was pointedly an unequal contest where the Western powers imposed their writ on a less powerful enemy. The new United Nations and NATO administrators in Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Bosnia were not empire as it was, but they were imperialistic in their attitude to the peoples they commanded. In other respects, the war was very different from the old colonial wars. One major difference was that if you were to think of the new humanitarianism was an imperial ethos, it was markedly different from the old, in the most obvious sense that the empire of human rights belonged to no one in particular, and to no particular power. Though the anti-war activists called it an American empire, it was not that in name, but instead acted in the name of a community of nations. Michael Hart and Antonio Negri argued in their book of the same name that empire in 2000 was a system of global ordering that had broken free of any particular nation state. The humanitarian interventionists were right to argue that the conditions were new, but ought to have understood that it was the West that had changed more than the world beyond it had. The perception that the world was dominated by rogue states and cartoon villain dictators said more about the West's yearning to cast itself as the hero of the story than it did about real world developments. What had changed was the West, America and Europe, in their need post-Cold War to define themselves for themselves a raison d'etre, a reason for existing. International relations analyst Philip Cunliffe shows how this moral imperialism made a de facto new standard of civilization that inscribed a new hierarchy into international politics by which certain states were deemed superior and others inferior. Though Cunliffe goes on to explain that this hierarchy This is a hierarchy that brings little order. Okay, so this is the denouement now, the passage on woke imperialism. So let's get to this. Over the centuries, Britain has, in different eras, imposed its will on peoples and nations beyond its borders. Those interventions and impositions have been different in different times, taking on the beliefs and preoccupations of the governing elite here and imposing it on people over there. The Elizabethan colonists took the rights of seizure for granted, but after the 1837 Select Committee on Aboriginal Peoples, colonists started to motivate their claims as part of a civilizing mission abroad, as their church missionaries argued. In the 20th century, the colonists often said that they were only looking after colonies on behalf of their native occupants and aiming to educate them to govern themselves at some point in the future. Today, too, when Britain's armed forces and government impose their will on others, they do so in keeping with the aims and sentiments of their own times. Our own times are a lot more liberal in outlook than they were. Ideas that owe their foundational formulation to the struggle for racial justice and even against imperialism are today mainstream. Ideas about women's liberation and even gay liberation that were alien to our Victorian forebears have today become embedded in the outlook of mainstream society. The new laws on equality of opportunity that were passed in the later 20th century and in the 21st have consolidated that broadly liberal trend in British society. The Racial Relations Act of 1965 and 1976, Equal Pay and Sex Discrimination Acts of 1971 and 1975, decriminalisation of homosexuality in 1967, equalisation of the age of consent for homosexuals in 2000, gay marriage in 2006, the Equality Act of 2006 and 2010. Liberal social views, however, have not done away with the encounter between a more peaceful Britain and a more powerful Britain and less powerful nations in the world. They can lead to some strange paradoxes as British leaders motivate their actions overseas in ways that seem at odds with the unequal power relationship. With humanitarian intervention, ethical foreign policy that Britain developed in the 1990s, intervention was, as we have seen, motivated as the defence of the rights of the people of the countries that were being attacked, on the premise that their governments were oppressive and illiberal, which was generally true. The end point, as the critics argued, was quite often not an improvement, however. Labour MP Anne Clude played a big part in rallying liberal opinion in favour of the 1991 Iraq War, which he did by highlighting the plight of Iraqi Kurds who were subject to violent oppression under Saddam's regime. On the 1st of October 2001, Development Minister Claire Short deflected criticisms of the bombing of Afghanistan and the House of Commons by painting the British mission there as one to bring aid to the hungry and to educate children. This is Claire Short. On behalf of our government, I undertook to work with the government in the Northwest Frontier Province to ensure as rapidly as possible boys and girls are educated. In the Guardian newspaper, Catherine Wiener cautioned that the US military interventions overseas that Britain was supporting were a case of feminism as imperialism, a theft of feminist rhetoric in pursuit of national expansion. A report by the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction into US efforts since 2002 to support Afghan women and girls and advance gender equality points out that the $787 million budgeted for such programs underestimates the real figure, because hundreds of other US programs and projects included an unquantified gender component. Gender mainstreaming advocated bringing women's issues and perspectives into all programs and policies. Quotas for women representatives in Gurga or Parliament were so successful that 27% were women, a greater share than were in Congress. The Special Inspector General did worry that women parliaments have limited connection with their constituencies, and some have never even been to the provinces they represent. Those fears proved prescient. The withdrawal of the US military support for the Afghan government in August 2021 saw it collapse in 48 hours as the Taliban took over. Nice one. At the National Army Museum, the armed forces are presented as a changing institution that is working to overcome its history of discrimination. Today, the army is lauded as an employer that celebrates diversity. Women make up about 9% of the current force, and in 2016, it reached number 32 in Stonewall's top 100 inclusive employers for lesbian, gay, and bisexual staff. Oh, nice one. To many critics of Britain's military role overseas, the claims that the army is an equal opportunities employer ring hollow as they see the army's role overall as one of reinforcing oppression. In a compelling analysis of Western AIDS policy and how it works in Mozambique, LSE academic Meera Sabhatram argues for a decolonization of intervention, looking at the ways that aid intervention has worked to undermine native agency. Sabaratanam calls for a reversed understanding of who deserves what out of intervention. In this story, it is the target of aid who is entitled to it materially by virtue of historical patterns of imperial dispossession. So this woman calls for a policy of intervention to fix the impact of previous intervention. It is not as remarkable as it might appear to the casual reader. Under James Wolfson, the World Bank looked again at its own record of setting conditions on loans to developing countries and found that these were often damaging to the economies that they were supposed to be helping. Instead of imposing conditions on loans, the World Bank and other international institutions insisted that they would become partners in poverty reduction. British Chancellor Gordon Brown characterized the shift in attitude as follows. A century ago, people talked of what we could do for Africa. Last century is what we can do for Africa. Now, in 2006, we must ask what the developing world empowered can do for itself. Those were brief promises, but how did they work out in practice? Looking, for example, at Tanzania, researcher John Pender outlines the ways that the World Bank's poverty reduction schemes turned out to be just as patrician and coercive as the previous structural adjustment programs. The bank went through the process of agreeing poverty reduction schemes with the Tanzanian government. At the same time, these agreements were used to sideline the Tanzanian parliament and the political process. Though the new approach emphasized country ownership, as the humanitarian interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq claimed to be liberating the people of those countries, the conundrum remained that the developed countries were telling the less developed countries what they had to do to be free. In international diplomacy, British promotion began to take on the character of a woke imperialism, where it seemed that Britain's mission overseas was nothing to do with advancing British interests, but instead a campaign to educate Muslim girls, stamp out racism, and mend the damage caused by imperialism. In the older imperial project, those people who resisted the British presence were often traduced and dehumanized in ways that made sense to Britons in those days. Muslims were often portrayed as effete and predatory homosexuals. In 1849, Brigadier General Williams claimed that had the Turks penetrated into Georgia last campaign, very few youths of either sex would have escaped pollution. The year before, the Anti-Slavery Society claimed that the brutish idolaters and low-caste Mohammedans who had migrated to the West Indies as indentured labourers are guilty of the vile practices of alleged, meaning homosexual acts. Today, the British Foreign Office helpfully advises lesbian and gay visitors to Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other countries in the Middle East that homosexuality is illegal in those countries. The Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office campaigns for lesbian and gay rights to be recognized across the world. Over the last 170 years, it is not the Middle East that has changed to become more anti-gay, but rather Britain that has changed, liberalizing its laws on gay rights as the attitude of its citizens has become more liberal. The idea that Muslims were effeminate back then was really just an upside-down reflection of how fundamental masculine values were to Victorian society. that Britain's laws have subsequently changed makes Saudi Arabia's or Zimbabwe's intolerance on the matter stand out to a British traveller. Those are the real problems that minorities in other countries face. They are also part of the account of the superiority of British society that makes it possible for Britons to believe that they have a right to reform other countries for the good of their different peoples. That's right, those nasty Zimbabweans and Saudi Arabians should really allow bum sex for all. When British leaders try to distance themselves from the record of the British Empire, they make intervention more palatable, but they also risk opening themselves up to criticism. Prime Minister Tony Blair's address to the September 2002 Earth Summit in South Africa was upstaged by Namibia's president, Sam Nujoma, who roundly attacked Blair for rallying sanctions against Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe. It was Britain that had created the land problem in Zimbabwe in the first place, argued Nujoma, while the British Prime Minister had to suffer the public attack. Woke imperialism has its risks for political leaders, but in relations between Britain and the developing world, those are bound to reflect the attitudes that Britons hold, and particularly those that are distinct from those held by other people. And I think I will end there. I think it was it's a pretty good passage that I've read out, this chapter. Really interesting book. I mean, this is a book that goes through the entire British Empire. And what he's arguing in this section is that, in a sense, this kind of woke imperialism is basically a way of Britain imposing its moral vision on the rest of the world. The trouble is that the moral vision of the of wokery is disgusting to the rest of the world. It is rejected by any place that has any respect for its own culture, its own traditions. What Hartfield does not say is that the ideology of the woke and the ideology, this kind of liberal ideology, is a kind of dissolving acid that will destroy literally any place it touches. It, you know, anything that the people of those places hold dear, any part of their histories, their cultures, their moral values will be dissolved, and it will be turned into essentially a kind of theme park where that culture is sold back on itself. Now, Hartfield doesn't get into all of that. It's a really beyond the remit of his book. But I thought it was an interesting way in, really, to lay bare exactly what is happening. And honestly, I reject this wholesale because the fundamental values themselves are evil. And we can see the damage that they've done to our own countries. So wishing to impose them on other countries, you know, well, it can only end in disaster, not just for us, but for everybody else too. So anyway, that will do for today. A bit of a longer video today, but I thought it was necessary to read that whole section. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.